I'm going to call the Joint Senate Environment and Energy Committee and the House Energy Policy Committee hearing to order. Today we're talking about conservation, and we have an expert here from out of town. The way we're going to do this is kind of like we did the Public Utilities Commission a couple weeks ago when we were together. We will let the presenters complete their entire presentation, and if you have a question, write it down. And after an hour of presentations, we'll have 30 minutes for member questions. And with that, Mr. Kushler, please introduce yourself and your affiliation, and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman, Chairpersons Hartman and Marty. I'm very appreciative that we could get a joint committee hearing today for this very important subject. I'm very pleased to be here. I am Martin Kushler. I'm with the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, and I do quite a bit of work with various states on energy efficiency policies and so forth, and I've done a fair amount of work here in Minnesota over the years, and it's a real pleasure to be here to speak with you today. As my title suggests, Minnesota is doing pretty well on utility sector energy efficiency. I often refer to Minnesota as a good example for other states. So please don't interpret anything I have to say as criticism of Minnesota. But I would like to maybe help inspire Minnesota to do even more on energy efficiency, and that'll be one of the purposes of my discussion here today with you. This is just a slide to provide some background information about myself and my organization. I'll just mention a couple of pertinent items. I did serve for 10 years on the staff of the Michigan Public Service Commission. I was the director of evaluation there. So I do have a pretty good background on utility regulatory matters. And towards the bottom, it lists some of the involvement I've had with the SIP program here over the years in Minnesota. It's good to be back. So topics today, I do have quite a few slides to get through, so I'll be moving through fairly quickly. Be happy to answer any questions later, or if necessary, follow-up calls. Happy to respond to any inquiries about any of the material I present today. But I will, I'd like to focus first on Minnesota's unique energy disadvantage, I guess is the way I'm referring to it, and why energy efficiency should be a top priority energy policy for the state of Minnesota. I'll provide some foundational information on energy efficiency as a utility system resource. That's a particularly important aspect of all of this. Talk about some of the regulatory concerns relating to that subject. I'll touch briefly on energy efficiency as economic development tool. I want to spend a few minutes on a few current hot topics in the industry today. Just to give you my latest observations on some of those. And then finally, I'll talk about how Minnesota compares to other states around the country. Actually assign a grade, hope no one minds for that, and talk a little bit about opportunities for further progress in the state. So let's start with key point number one. Minnesota has a big energy problem. Minnesota uses a lot of energy. Total cost in 2000, which was kind of before the higher cost era of energy came upon us, was $12 billion a year. By 2010, that had climbed to $21 billion per year. But the really most important feature of Minnesota's situation is that you're essentially totally dependent on fuels imported from other states and countries. Minnesota imports 100% of the coal and uranium used, 100% of the oil and petroleum products, and 100% of the natural gas. Take a look at the costs of those imports. Again, before the higher cost energy era was upon us, in 2000, it was about $7 billion a year left the state. By 2010, at market prices, that was over $13 billion a year, leaving the state to import energy fuels. This is a huge economic drain on Minnesota's state economy. To help put that economic drain in perspective, this is a graph showing the economic burden on Minnesota homes and businesses of state taxes versus energy costs in 2010. Left column, total Minnesota taxes for that year, $14.2 billion. Total energy costs, about $21 billion. But again, most importantly, $13 billion left the state to import energy fuels. And in most states, and I think Minnesota is probably typical, you get an awful lot of discussion about that left bar. You know, how can we relieve that burden on people? Not so much discussion about that right bar on energy costs. And one, and there is one critical difference. Virtually every dollar in that left bar, the state tax revenue collected, virtually every dollar of that gets re-spent in the state. Whereas the yellow shaded bar, the lower half of the right bar, those fuel dollars exported to import fuel, that dollar, those dollars all leave the state. Very different consequences for the state economy. Another way to conceptualize this, that just the additional $6 billion due to the higher market prices over the year 2000, just the additional $6 billion is roughly equivalent to the lost payroll from closing 120 major manufacturing plants. And I've included on the slide, you can do the math yourself. That's assuming 1,000 jobs at $50,000 a piece per plant. And those lost dollars that leave for energy are just as gone from the economy as lost payroll from a plant. And as I mentioned here, even the Wall Street Journal has written about the unprecedented transfer of wealth from most states to a handful of states and countries that are big energy exporters. Which brings me to key point number two, and that is that Minnesota's future is not in fossil fuels. Minnesota is blessed with lots of natural resources, but when it comes to fossil fuels, Minnesota got shut out. This slide shows Minnesota's recoverable reserves as a share of U.S. recoverable reserves. Coal, 0%, oil, 0%, natural gas, 0%, uranium, 0%. So it leads to the question, why would Minnesota support policies that encourage greater consumption of those resources, either at the state or federal level? I have a series of maps here just to rub it in a little bit. Minnesota's energy predicament. You'll notice that Minnesota is the only Midwest state with no reserves of any of these fuels, which is why I refer to Minnesota's unique disadvantage when it comes to energy. First slide is coal production. You can see the shaded areas are the states that produce coal. Minnesota's dollars basically flow to Montana and Wyoming for coal. You can look at oil proved reserves. Again, Minnesota conspicuously blanked in terms of any recoverable reserves. And even shale, which is everybody's big euphoria these days, Minnesota, again, missed the train when it comes to shale deposits. So I think the conclusion from all of this, I believe, is that, you know, given that reality, as a matter of state policy, Minnesota should be trying to maximize the amount of energy efficiency it can accomplish and minimize the amount of additional fuel imports that it needs. And that leads me to some good news, and that is that key point number three, it's much cheaper to save energy than it is to produce it. We can save electricity for about one-third the cost of producing it through a new power plant, and with the added benefit of no carbon emissions. This is a slide showing the relative cost of new electricity resources. I particularly like to use this one because it's prepared by Lazard Inc., which is, as I understand it, the largest consulting firm to the international banking community. So this is not something put together by a bunch of tree huggers. This is what they tell their business clients about the relative cost of energy sources. If I had a pointer, it would be a little easier to point these out. But if you look at the first bar, energy efficiency, coming in at about 3 cents kilowatt hour. Moving right on the graph, wind, biomass, natural gas, combined cycle, and pulverized coal, probably the main sources that you look at, and you can see energy efficiency about a third to a fourth the cost of traditional fueled power plants. And you'll notice there's double bars next to these resources. The bar on the right in each pair is what the cost would be if there was a $20 per ton carbon cost attached to that resource. And the energy efficiency, of course, no additional cost, but you see that natural gas adds almost a penny a kilowatt hour and coal almost 2 cents a kilowatt hour to the price of power from those sources. This next graph is a later version from the same company. What is most noteworthy here, it's in slightly different format. These bars show the low and high estimates of the cost for each of these resources. You'll notice that the natural gas cost has gone down a bit in recognition of the lower market cost of natural gas lately. So it is a little more favorable than coal now, but you'll also notice the midpoint on energy efficiency bar is about 2.5 cents kilowatt hour, still a third to a fourth the cost of other competing resources. So again, thinking about state policy, Minnesota's electricity policy should be trying to maximize the amount of energy efficiency resources it can acquire and minimize the amount of new power plants needed. And this is, in fact, a declared policy of a number of leading states. You may have heard the expression energy efficiency being first in the loading order of resources for utilities. A number of states now have that as part of their state policy, meaning they need to exploit as much as possible of cost-effective energy efficiency before moving on to build power plants. This is just the next slide, policy priority one. It says is just to emphasize the importance of utility sector energy efficiency programs. Indeed, when you look at states around the country that are leaders on energy efficiency, their utility-funded efficiency programs are the cornerstone of virtually every state's energy efficiency efforts. And really a couple pretty simple reasons for that. One is that states don't spend tax dollars on energy efficiency programs. They're all broke, basically. And secondly, utilities routinely spend billions of dollars a year operating and fueling and our power systems. And so you can achieve an enormous amount of energy efficiency for a very small fraction of the amount of money that's already flowing through the utility system. And so with that background information, I did want to talk a little bit more about that concept of energy efficiency as a utility system resource. And in a nutshell, this is the rationale for energy efficiency as a utility system resource. Simply stated, utility systems need to have adequate supply resources to meet customer demand. And to keep that system in balance, you can add supply, you can reduce demand, or you can do a combination of the two. And in virtually every instance these days, it's much cheaper to reduce customer demand than it is to acquire new supply resources. Hence, energy efficiency becomes a core resource for the utility system. And I like to refer to this as energy efficiency on a power plant scale. I list some leading state examples here, and I do, when I talk to other states, I do point to Minnesota. You guys have a very long track record compared to a lot of states, some good accomplishments there. At this point, there are over a dozen states that have energy efficiency programs in the utility sector on a scale large enough to displace power plants. In other words, saving 1% of load or more. And I list those states there. So we have a lot of good experience out there. But my favorite example is the Pacific Northwest. They have the best electric resource planning process in the country, 30 years of efficiency program experience. I'm going to show you a couple slides. The first is from their 2005 plan, which was to meet all new electric resource needs through 2013 and two-thirds of the needs through 2025 with energy efficiency at a cost of 2.4 cents kilowatt hour. This is a kind of a graphical illustration of that. The big wedge at the bottom is energy efficiency. The wedge in the middle is wind power. And then there are a couple little bitty slivers at the top for combined cycle gas and a possible coal plant. And I remember at the time the planners told me they didn't think they'd ever need the coal plant, but they had it in the plan just in case in out years. And what we have seen is they have exceeded the planned targets for energy efficiency every year. The next graph shows bars of the target compared to the actual achieved savings, and you can see the actual savings that exceeded the target pretty substantially every year. So what that the next slide is a kind of a squiggly line graph which shows the relative cost of energy efficiency resources, which is that flat blue line towards the bottom of the graph, less than 2 cents a kilowatt hour, And the red lines are the market costs, the wholesale market cost of electricity, and they vary during different periods for different reasons. But as you can see, a considerable margin of savings with the energy efficiency versus wholesale market cost of electricity. And so then finally from the Northwest, this is the graph from their 2010 plan. And again, you see basically the same wedges, energy efficiency, the big wedge at the base, and then wind, RPS wind is the next one up. And then they actually plan on exceeding their RPS, doing some extra wind. And then finally, a little bit of gas again, a number of years out after 2020. And coal has disappeared entirely from their resource plan. It's just not competitive anymore. So Pacific Northwest provides a great example of what is possible for a state to follow in terms of their resource planning. And I think it really, really underscores the point that Minnesota can chart an energy course that is fundamentally based on energy efficiency and cost-effective local Minnesota renewable resources. And given the Minnesota's energy disadvantage that we covered earlier, I would really encourage you to think about that kind of an aggressive policy. And speaking of policy, I wanted to talk a little bit on why policymakers and regulators are so important if all this good energy efficiency stuff is going to happen. From a public policy standpoint, it's important to keep in mind that most of the extra benefits of energy efficiency are external to the economic interests of utilities. Things like reduced consumption of natural resources, reduced air emissions, reduced energy imports, or there are benefits that are long-term in nature, long-term avoided system costs. But under traditional regulation, the short-term economic interests of utilities are adversely affected by customer energy efficiency. And really, there are two key factors at play here. And I apologize for those of you who have a good grounding in this, but I think it is important to really understand the basics of the economic situation for utilities to really understand the need for public policy in this area. Under traditional regulation, once rates are set, if utility sales go up, utilities profits generally increase. If sales go down, if, for example, through customer efficiency, utilities profits tend to decline. So utilities have a strong economic incentive to seek greater energy sales and to avoid declines in sales. This is sometimes referred to as throughput addiction. Utilities like to see lots of throughput through their system and sales to customers. But the second piece of this, which is also an important factor, is that utilities earn a rate of return on their supply-side investments, power plants, wires, poles, meters, and so forth. But typically on energy efficiency programs, those are just expense. The costs are just passed through. There's no opportunity to make any profit there. So we combine those two factors, and not surprisingly, what we have gotten historically over the years from utilities are proposals to build more power plants and sell more energy, and passive or active opposition to strong energy efficiency requirements. Now that's varied. Some utilities are less oppositional than others, but these fundamental economics are a reality of the economic factors that utility management face, and they need to be recognized if a state's going to really move forward with aggressive energy efficiency. And if you dig a little closer into this, there's three key financial concerns. The first is cost recovery for the direct cost of a program, some mechanism to pay for the programs that are delivered to customers. The second is this issue of disincentives, the lost revenues if customers use less of their product. And then the third is the providing an opportunity for earnings for engaging in this energy efficiency activity. And we like to refer to that as the three legs of the financial stool for utility energy efficiency programs: cost recovery, doing something about the throughput disincentive, and an opportunity to have some earnings from doing a good job with efficiency. Now, Minnesota has addressed some of these issues. My take is that Minnesota's financial stool is a little bit unbalanced right now. maybe a little too much reliance on the incentives aspect, the third leg, and really haven't resolved the second leg of that stool yet. So that's one area where I think some improvements could be made. And I did want to talk a little bit more about that second leg. Revenue decoupling is the term of art that's used in the industry for this. And what this means essentially is that when utilities rates has a rate case, rates are set based on the forecast of consumption of energy. And what decoupling does is it says if actual sales vary from that forecast, up or down, we're going to true things up. So if sales are lower, say for example from energy efficiency, will allow the utility to recover back up to their authorized return of fixed costs. But if sales are higher, and this is the trade-off that protects ratepayers, if sales are higher than forecast, then they refund the difference to get back, so they're recovering their authorized costs, but not excessive recovery. Originally, this was a kind of a challenge in the regulatory community, but over the years, it's growing fast. There's something like 15 states now that have some form of electric revenue decoupling for electric utilities. It's not essential to achieving programs. You can get energy efficiency programs done in a state without decoupling, Minnesota being an example. It's not sufficient by itself. You can't just say we're going to decouple and all of a sudden these great programs will happen. So it's not sufficient. But I've increasingly come to the belief, and I think it's emerging as a consensus, that addressing utility disincentive from these lost sales is essential if you're going to achieve true utility cooperation in broader energy efficiency objectives. Things like better building codes, stronger appliance standards, true support of government programs and public awareness programs, climate goals being a real key one. I think this revenue decoupling issue has to be solved if we're ever going to seriously address climate problems that we face. Utilities can be motivated to some extent through direct performance incentives, but that effect really only applies to the targeted programs. It doesn't spill over into support for all these other initiatives that if a state like Minnesota with this energy disadvantage, you would like to have a multifaceted approach to energy efficiency so that everybody's pushing in the same direction to achieve that energy efficiency. Just briefly, a fourth key point I wanted to make, and that is energy efficiency is really Minnesota's best opportunity for economic development. I refer to this as the energy efficiency being the economic triple play. The first is the direct employment delivered by the programs. You know, you hire people to deliver programs. That's pretty straightforward. Any type of new energy project produces that first benefit. And frankly, you could dig a hole and fill it back up and you'd produce jobs to pay the people doing the digging and filling. But the second and third benefits are benefits that only energy efficiency produces. The second is local respending of the saved energy dollars. So when people participate in the programs and their bills go down, they have more money in their pocket, that money gets respent locally. And there are a lot of smart economists who can model the effects that has on the economy. But the third effect is even broader than that, and that is it goes beyond just the participants. That's all ratepayers. I showed you earlier the cost slide on different types of electric resources. Well, if you're buying the cheapest resource and it's only costing you 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt hour, you're reducing costs for all ratepayers because you're not buying the 8 or 10 cent resource. So that provides a very strong overall economic benefit to the state economy because your total costs of securing energy have gone down for everyone. And the last little carrot there, even beyond what you can see in terms of the direct costs, there's also some beneficial effect of driving down market prices for energy because of the lower overall demand. And a couple of the jurisdictions in New England have started to do a really good job of modeling that. They call it DRIPE, D-R-I-P-E. It's demand reduction induced price effects. At some point, it might be useful to have folks here do some modeling on that subject. But in any case, very strong positive economic development benefits from efficiency that no other energy resource can match. It can't. No other resource hits all three of those categories. And I wanted to briefly touch on three miscellaneous current hot topics in the industry. First, you may have heard some buzz around this issue. Do current low natural gas prices mean that energy efficiency is not needed? The answer very strongly is no. That doesn't mean that. Energy efficiency is still very cost effective. On the next graph, I'll show you some data on that. And in the appendix, there are a few slides at the end I'm not going to talk about, but there are a couple slides in there on natural gas efficiency programs as well. The second point here is that natural gas prices won't stay this low for very long. I did a pretty deep dive into the gas production industry this past summer, and I have an entire presentation on this subject I've given to NARUC and a few other conferences in the last 6 months. Bottom line is there are many good reasons to believe that natural gas prices will be noticeably higher in the next 5 to 10 years, and perhaps exceedingly higher, depending on how certain risk factors play out in the industry. So if you're looking at investments in a resource that have 10, 20, 30-year time horizons, clearly within those time horizons, natural gas prices are going to be much higher than what we're looking at right now. So nobody should be making short-term decisions based on short-term pricing in the gas industry. This is a slide. The next slide is one that I borrowed from the folks in the Pacific Northwest. It takes a look at the levelized cost of combined cycle combustion turbine electricity at various natural gas prices and capacity factors for the plants. And even at the ridiculously low gas price of $1 or $2 a million BTU, which are the left two clusters, energy efficiency is still cheaper than an optimally running maximum capacity combined cycle plant at $1 or $2 gas. Moving to the right side of the graph is where more realistic territory resides. Many experts in the gas industry believe that we will need to see gas prices in the range of $5 to $6 an MBTU in order to sustain fracking as a viable large-scale industry. So if you go over to the farthest right cluster, that's $6 an MMBTU for gas. You can look at the price wedges there. The price wedge on the far right is energy efficiency, and the three on the left are gas at different capacity factors for those plants. Clearly, even at absurdly low gas prices, energy efficiency is still far more cost effective. Climate change, don't want to say too much about that. Most of it's pretty self-explanatory, but clearly energy efficiency is by far the cheapest resource option. I showed you earlier how much even a modest cost for carbon, $20 a ton, adds to the cost of fossil fuel electricity. Energy efficiency is a no-regrets policy because its other benefits are so large, even if you don't think carbon is really a problem. But there's general consensus that people have done the modeling. Any serious plan to slow down climate change must have energy efficiency as its top priority policy. And a number of states now do have kind of parallel objectives relating to greenhouse gases that intersect with their energy efficiency policies. And then the last hot topic I want to talk about is industrial customers. I want to address a commonly heard myth that industrial customers already pursue all available energy efficiency because it's in their self-interest already to do so. The basic problem is large corporations will generally be guided by economic return rules of thumb. Historically, it's been looked at as about a 2-year payback. Now it's probably closer to a 1-year payback now that the economy is so tight. I have a little mathematical example here. I'll just cut to the chase and say, if you assume a 2-year payback for a device, an energy efficiency device, and you stop there, a two-year payback at typical industrial rates, it works out to about 1.9 cents a kilowatt hour. So what that means is any efficiency measure that has a longer than two-year payback won't be get done by the customer. So that means that anything that costs more than 1.9 cents a kilowatt hour won't get done. That obviously leaves a huge amount of energy efficiency on the table. There are ways to get around this. Utility programs can and should really focus on this. The next slide that I have up now walks you through a mathematical example of how if the utility just provides a rebate, if a customer has a four-year payback project, it would never get done under current economic hurdle requirements for typical corporations. Utility can buy that down from 4 years to two. The cost of the utility, again, is 1.9 cents a kilowatt hour. They're buying large amounts of efficiency from the industrial customer for less than 2 cents a kilowatt hour. This is a win-win opportunity. The customer gets a much more efficient facility. They get revenue stream from the efficiency, and the utility gets the cheapest resource available. The next slide is just an example. Typically, industrial customer associations have opposed efficiency. There are a few examples where they've really gotten on board with this, and I have a quote here from Massachusetts, which is now the most aggressive state in the country. They're going to be saving 2.4% of their electricity sales every year, and their industrial associations are on board and want to get part of the revenue from that by selling efficiency. So I'll quickly walk you through some comparisons of Minnesota to other states so you can see where you stand. The first map is a map of energy efficiency resource standards. You all know Minnesota is at 1.5%. This shows you what other states in the region and around the country have for their standards. Minnesota, pretty good shape, 1.5%. Some of the Midwest states go to 2, but they're not there yet. They're phasing in over many years. A couple of the East Coast utilities are already over 2%. So, you know, some room for improvement, but pretty good. Next line graph shows the cumulative savings through 2020. Minnesota is in probably the upper third of this line graph. Again, you know, pretty good performance, but still some room to do better. I have a table that shows the actual percentage savings by 2020. Again, Minnesota in the upper third of these states with EERS standards, pretty good shape. You know, one caveat, these are projected savings, and some states do a better job of following through than others. So there are a couple in this list that I frankly don't think are ever going to get there, but most of them I think will. We look at this issue, the next bar graph is the results of how well states are doing meeting their targets, and with a couple of exceptions, states are generally meeting or exceeding their EERS targets. This is our map of our last national scorecard ranking all the states. Minnesota ranked 9th, highest rank in the Midwest. This shows the change in ranks for Midwest states since 2006. I put this in here just to show Minnesota is very good, but you're ranked the same as you were in 06, so maybe it's time for the next leap forward, as they say. Grading Minnesota. I'm a very tough grader, but overall I would say B+, A- for your utility sector energy efficiency policies and programs here. And I've listed here some areas for improvement to truly be top tier. I mean, if you really wanted to go full out and compete with the Massachusetts and Connecticut's and California's of the world, these are some things I would suggest. Find ways to push beyond the 1.5% a year savings target. I think there are some ways to do that. At some point, maybe we'll have opportunities to talk about that a little bit. Balance the three-legged stool. Moderate the incentive side, add decoupling to build that third leg in. Improve industrial buy-in to the energy efficiency strategy. And by that, there's two elements to that. The first is get the industrial customer sector to buy into the concept of energy efficiency as a resource. that is good for them for the utility to be buying energy efficiency, even if they're not getting it from their plant, because it drives down the cost of resources to all customers. And then the second piece of that is get them to participate, design and deliver really good programs that they want to participate in. Related to that, industrial challenges is find a way to capture CHP as a win-win for all. I think there are ways to do that. There's a Minnesota is a little lower ranked than in terms of CHP. I think there are some opportunities to really improve that in a way that do it in a way that utilities can see that as a win as well as the customer. Formally incorporate utility energy efficiency into state air quality objectives, ideally including greenhouse gases. This is something that EPA is really excited about, helping states to allow their utility efficiency programs to provide credits towards air quality goals. There's a lot of room for coordination there. Ensure performance, good performance by all utilities. Some utilities are doing better than others here. And finally, there are some specific things that can be done with hookup fees and rate design to help incentivize efficiency. So finally, just a few conclusions. Again, Minnesota has a very good record on energy efficiency, but there are substantial opportunities to do even better. And with the energy disadvantage I talked about, there are substantial reasons to do even better. And if you ever want to get around to having a serious climate policy and greenhouse gas goals, energy efficiency is the frosting on the cake for that. And that's all that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Kushler. Just one quick question. CHP, combined heat and power?
Yes.
And while the Department of Commerce comes down, we had three questions. Members, if you want to get added to the list, just raise your hand, and my committee administrator will write down your name. And when all the presentations are done, we'll go to questions. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Please state your name and your affiliation for the tape. And then, senators, in case you don't know, the House sound system, I think, is worse than the Capitol, and we get interference from cell phones. So if you can turn off your cell phone. Otherwise, that little beep we hear is you getting a text message or you getting an email.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. Bill Grant for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I have with me Jessica Verdette, our SIP supervisor, who I wanted to introduce to the committee members. If the question gets particularly difficult, I'll be tossing them to her. I wanted to start by giving you a brief overview of the history of the Conservation Improvement Program in Minnesota. As you can see, this dates all the way back to 1980. There have been a number of innovations along the way. Most notably when we added spending requirements in the late 80s, and then when in 2007 the Next Generation Energy Act required that we have a savings target in addition to a spending target. And what we've found as a result is that the savings target has driven a lot more energy efficiency than what we were achieving prior to that. As the technologies change and savings are achieved, the program has evolved to meet needs of customers and market demands. We've had a long and collaborative relationship with utilities and industry stakeholders to identify and address challenges and opportunities so that we can save more energy going forward. And I think we've achieved a consistent level of savings by many utilities, which are both measurable and verifiable. So why do we do energy efficiency? It's for a lot of the reasons that Mr. Kushler outlined for you just moments ago, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Clearly, there are ratepayer benefits in the form of reduced consumption and demand to help lower energy costs. reduced utility costs and ability to manage energy use better. And then, of course, there are the environmental benefits. On the utility side, they avoid costly investments in new generation, transmission, distribution, and can really help achieve the goals of meeting both base and intermediate and peaking demand on their customers' systems. Just to give you a sense of how energy conservation fits into the larger regulatory scheme here in Minnesota, this schematic gives you an overview of how we think of the various processes. And you'll notice on the far left-hand side of that schematic, DSM stands for Demand Side Management, which in Minnesota is known as SIP. As with other resources that the utility plans for in meeting customer demand, DSM is one of those that goes into the resource planning process that we conduct with all of our electric utilities. To the extent then that resource needs are identified and supply side resources are identified as the best means to achieve those, we go through a certificate of need process. If need for that facility is determined to be present, that facility then goes through a facility permitting process to determine where it's going to be located and how any impacts from that facility can be mitigated. And then finally, all of those costs get rolled up in the form of rates and presented to the Public Utilities Commission in a rate case. And so DSM costs are clearly a part of those costs going forward, but as you've seen from Mr. Kushler's slides, in most cases, in fact, in all cases that we're aware of here in Minnesota, those energy efficiency costs are substantially lower than the cost of meeting similar supply needs with new supply side resources. Some of the things that we do currently as part of our responsibilities in managing the SIP program, we provide technical assistance and outreach to over 130 municipal utilities, 44 distribution co-ops, and 11 investor-owned utilities, both natural gas and electric. We review and evaluate plans on a rolling three-year basis. The munis and co-ops file their plans annually, and all utilities are reporting their SIP performance to us on a yearly basis. We, that's at the staff level, review those plans and those reports conduct analysis to determine whether or not goals are being met or not. And we do an extensive job now of managing measurement and verification of savings. This is one of the things that I think has probably improved the most in the SIP program over the last five or so years, is that we've really ramped up our ability to pinpoint accurately the amount of savings that are occurring on utility systems, so that from the slide earlier, we can actually then use that data about what amount of demand is actually being saved and when it's being saved, so that it really does become part of the resource mix that a utility considers in meeting their customer needs. Several years ago, this body also authorized an assessment for the purpose of doing advanced conservation research and development so that we can really identify new opportunities, both on the technology side and on the program design side, for utilities to exploit as they move forward. Some of the current areas of interest that I think are important for you to be aware of. First, this body has, in a couple of different iterations, allowed larger customers to opt out of the SIP program, in other words, not participate and not have their bills reflect a SIP surcharge. This has, I think, created some issues for utilities in meeting their energy savings goals. We're concerned that we may not be achieving the same level of efficiency from those larger customers that we would be if they were still participating in the program. Low-income programs is another area, and you'll be, I'm sure, hearing more about this during the course of the session. Presently, all utilities under the program are investing 0.2% of their gross operating revenues specifically on programs designed to target low-income customers. Many utilities use that as an opportunity to leverage the federal weatherization program and provide additional support to their local CAP agencies and other service providers move those programs forward. Couple of other areas that you're going to also be hearing, I think, more about: distributed generation and combined heat and power. There's a lot of interest around the state in identifying ways that distributed and CHP resources can be used in the same way as we're using more traditional demand-side management now to count toward savings goals and to really ramp up the amount of savings that we're achieving on the demand side. I think there's always an issue for us in terms of ongoing support needed for the staffing of SIP, both in our agency and in the utility end of things, and effective reporting tools that, as I was saying before, really allow us to measure and verify savings. The cost of maintaining that sort of a infrastructure is not insignificant. I mentioned low-income programs very quickly. The 0.2% spending requirement now results in about $8 million being spent annually across the state. And again, primarily that money is going to the weatherization program. We think it's well spent. It's leveraging additional economic activity, and it's serving those customers who really spend a much larger proportionate share of their own incomes on energy costs compared with the rest of the population. Just some performance metrics for you over the last few years. You can see that when the savings goals were added in 2007 and went into effect fully in 2010, the amount of savings that we're achieving has ramped up considerably, both for electric and natural gas utilities. I think that's a consequence of the policies this body has put in place. Just to do a little social math with you, we've saved about 2.5 million megawatt hours, and that's roughly the amount that would be used to heat, cool, and power about 46,000 homes in Minnesota every year. We've saved about 40 million tons of CO2 emissions, and that's enough to take about 170,000 cars off the road. And we've avoided the equivalent of 2 500 intermediate size power plants since 2007. Significant cost savings, not only for the utilities who have to make those investments, but for their ratepayers who have to pay for them. And this is a slide you've already seen, so I'll save the time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for condensing your 15-minute presentation into 10 minutes for us. And I mistakenly referred to Dr. Kushler as Mr. Kushler, so I guess for the rest of the hearing, if we can call him Dr. Kushler, I screwed that up. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, in fairness, he went to Michigan State, and as a U of M school, we know Michigan State really doesn't count as a legitimate school. Right?
We'll get into collegiate rivalries in the question and answer period. The next person we're going to hear from is Lee Gabler from Xcel Energy. He's the Director of Demand Side Management. And he will be the first presenter to talk about the utilities experience with the Conservation Improvement Program. And sorry about all the acronyms for members. But by the end of the day, we should know what they all mean. Go ahead and state your name and your affiliation and move forward with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Lee Gabler, and I am the Director of Conservation or Demand Side Management and Renewable Programs for Xcel Energy, and I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak today. When we look at Minnesota SIP programs, we're really proud of what we call the Minnesota model. Minnesota policymakers and key stakeholders have what we believe set the state on a course for success when it comes to conservation improvement programs. Specifically, we have the right rules in place and have developed the right business and regulatory framework. We've aligned utility industry interests with state policy objectives, and the end result is cost-effective and nation-leading energy efficiency and conservation programs and results. I know that both Dr. Kushler and Mr. Grant talked about the state of Minnesota being number 9 when it comes to the 2012 ACEEE report card. There's also a subset of that report card where Minnesota ranks 2nd in regards to utility and public benefit programs and policies, and I think that's really important because it ties to what we offer from a conservation program standpoint today. The Minnesota model has created the right environment for Xcel Energy to exceed very aggressive energy savings goals. Very quickly, we've talked about what is SIP. The purpose of SIP for us is really to promote the awareness and adoption of energy efficiency technologies to reduce use, costs, and emissions. Current energy savings targets for both electricity and gas have been established by the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. Programs offered by the utilities must pass cost-effectiveness tests, and all customers, except for a very small handful of large customers, are exempt from the cost, but everyone has the benefits of these programs. Some examples of SIC programs. Xcel Energy conservation programs are available to business, residential, and income-qualified customers. In 2012, when we look at our electric savings, roughly 70% of the savings are attributed to our commercial customers, 30% to residential. And when we look on the gas side of our business, about 60% of our energy savings comes from the business sector, 40% to residential. Some specific examples of programs: we have lighting programs for both commercial and residential customers, insulation rebates, home energy audits. We do school education kits, so we're in the sixth grade classroom teaching kids about energy efficiency. Energy design assistance for new buildings. We have an energy feedback pilot that we partner with O-Power on. And I think one of the comments from Dr. Kushler around the industrial program, one of our largest programs that we have on the business side is called process efficiencies. And that generates roughly about 15% of our overall savings comes from those large industrial customers who are looking for improvements in their facilities and in their processes. You know, we're all about engaging customers through these programs. We really want to look at a holistic approach and build partnerships with our customers and build a sustainable model going forward. Our idea is not to have kind of a one-and-done project. We want to work, especially with our commercial customers, on what is their go-forward energy savings plan. We offer rebates, education, equipment contractor outreach, technical support. We recommend financing options, and we're also now really getting involved with the local communities, telling the communities what we have to offer, because that is another vehicle and another channel to communicate to all of our customers. You know, beginning in 2010, Xcel Energy conservation programs and associated savings have seen some pretty rapid growth. Both in 2011 and 2012, the company's SIP performance exceeded the electric savings target of 1.5%, as well as the gas savings target of 1%. You know, the amount of electric energy saved in 2011 was enough to power all the residential homes in Bloomington for a year. The Minnesota model that I discussed at the very beginning of my remarks has been a critical component to our success. When we look at what we're spending for energy efficiency, I know that Dr. Kushler used Lazard. We use ACEEE as our benchmark. And it really lays out the average is we're performing significantly below the average for the lifetime cost per kWh of our programs. When I talked about the Minnesota model again, it's really challenging the utilities to become as cost effective and as efficient as possible in how we deliver our programs. So why we support SIP, I think it's pretty obvious. We've heard it. Everyone can benefit, whether it's participants, non-participants, businesses, communities, economic development. It provides our customers the choices that they want. How can they manage their energy use and control their costs? And significant benefits to the environment. We've been doing energy efficiency for Xcel Energy and Northern States Power Processor Company since the 80s. Since the early 90s, we've been able to avoid building 10 medium-sized power plants because of our programs. The financial incentive, we'll be honest, is very important to us. It sends the right message to the utilities. It awards the utilities based upon achievement of savings and cost effectiveness. It motivates the utilities and motivates Xcel Energy to manage our costs. We want to be as effective and, again, as cost efficient as possible. And the bottom line, it's a shared savings mechanism. Customers retain the vast majority of the net benefits. So looking ahead, we are in the first year of a new triennial plan. Over the next 3 years, we'll spend just over $250 million on our energy efficiency programs. We have set our goals to achieve the 1.5% as part of the Next Generation Energy Act on the electric side and 1% on the gas side. We've added additional programs to our mix. Really, we want to continue to leverage our success in the business sector with commercial efficiency and also get at the hard to reach, really the multifamily. We think there's significant opportunity with multifamily buildings. There are challenges. It's going to be a difficult road. Really, we have to look at things that will erode our energy savings, whether they're energy standards and codes. Appliances today are using less energy. One of the things we saw is many people have an iPad today. An iPad costs about $1.40 a year to power versus a PC, which is about $42. So even though that's not part of our program, customers are becoming more and more efficient. And new construction will be built to a higher level. And what isn't even mentioned here is the changes to the lighting standards. Clearly, as incandescents are being phased out, that will have a major impact on the programs that utilities have to offer as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Great job on time. Nick Mark from CenterPoint Energy is our next testifier. And Xcel has really laid down a challenge for you doing their 10-minute presentation in 8 minutes, so hopefully you can match that.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Nick Mark with CenterPoint Energy. As you know, CenterPoint Energy is the largest gas utility in Minnesota and one of the largest gas utility companies in the nation, with over 3 million gas customers in 6 states. In my role with the company, I have responsibility for the regulatory and policy aspects of our conservation program here in Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about that today. We've been delivering our programs since the 1990s and delivering significant savings and value for our customers through those programs. Our SIP programs include offerings for all of our customer classes and target nearly every gas end use. We've got a pretty mature and robust program, and we've been a leader nationally in gas utility energy efficiency. Our programs have repeatedly received national recognition, and we're pretty proud about that. In 2007, as you've heard a couple of times, the Next Generation Energy Act established minimum savings targets and raised the bar for utility achievement through conservation. Meeting those goals has required significant expansion for us of our programs and also of our conservation budgets. It's also required a significant degree of creativity and collaboration in the development and implementation of our programs. We've successfully partnered with Xcel Energy to offer several programs that benefit our joint customers, and we're excited about that collaboration as it moves forward. Now, these goals for the Next Generation Energy Act sets are particularly challenging for gas utilities because there are simply fewer opportunities for savings on the gas side than you've heard about on the electric side. Now, that's partly as a result of having had our programs in place for a number of years. The low-hanging fruit in terms of easy opportunities to save is largely gone at this point. In addition, there are fewer gas end uses and none being added, really. And you heard earlier about iPads. iPads don't use gas, so there's not a lot of savings there for us to capitalize on. Low gas prices have an effect to the extent that they can reduce customer willingness to invest in energy efficiency as the length of payback gets longer. And the increased stringency of building codes and appliance standards tends or can reduce the savings that are attributable to the utility programs. Overall, one of the largest points that I want to make is that the trend in customer usage is downward and has been declining for decades. Here you see our residential per customer consumption, residential and there's information here about the small business as well. Between 1997 and 2000, we added more than 142,000 residential and small business customers in Minnesota. That represents about 20% customer growth. But our overall weather-normalized sales to these customers declined by 3.5%. That, again, is the combined impact of improved building codes, appliance standards, and, again, utility conservation efforts themselves. And it's a good thing for our customers, but it does make achieving continued savings difficult. There's only so much energy being used that you can save, and you can't save what you're not using. So this trend is also one of the drivers of something of a mismatch between where we spend our SIP funds and where we get our savings. Here you see our 2011 program results broken down between residential and commercial customers. We often tend to think about energy efficiency programs in terms, or energy efficiency itself, in terms of what we can do in our home to save energy. But actually, residential customers, while they are the overwhelming majority of participants in our SIP programs and account for about two-thirds of our program savings, only represent about a third of the actual energy savings achieved. The commercial and industrial programs tend to produce more energy savings and do so more cost-effectively, simply because you're looking at a fewer number of larger energy savings projects. Now, there is certainly still opportunity on the residential side to continue to get savings, but achieving it requires a larger utility investment and costs more per unit of energy saved. And now, the trend that I've just described is also something that you see in our 2013 to 2015 program offerings. There's a similar split here in terms of where the funds are being spent and the expected savings from each of our market sectors. Now, as we continue to, in our efforts to achieve the ambitious energy targets that have been set, we've increased our collaboration with Xcel, added new programs in each of our market sectors, and revised other programs as necessary to ensure that they're serving our customers as well as possible. I won't go through this laundry list of programs here, but I do believe we've put together a strong conservation portfolio, and I'm proud of both our achievements today and our plan moving forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions on our specific program offerings or any other topics that committee members might be interested in during the Q&A.
Thank you very much. You kind of creamed them. You did yours in 4 minutes. Our next presenter is Steve Kath from the Retrofit Companies. Please state your name and your affiliation. Thank you.
Sure. My name is Steve Kath. I'm with the Retrofit Companies out of Owatonna, Minnesota. And I'd like to thank Senator Marty and Madam Chair and the rest of the committee for allowing me to present my perspective from a job creator on energy efficiency. Last week when Barb asked me to testify today, I asked her how long I needed to speak, and she said, well, anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes. And I said, well, I don't know that I could talk that long without putting everybody to sleep. And she says, well, Steve, from what I heard, you remind us of the cross-eyed discus thrower. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She says, well, you're not going to set any records, but you will keep the crowd on their toes. So thanks for the confidence, Barb. I appreciate that. And I need to also... I was told when I was coming up to testify that my nephew and former representative Corey Kath asked me to not do anything or say anything that would embarrass him, so I guess I owe him an apology when I get home. So. With that, just a little bit about the background or my background. I started in the lighting industry in 1986, and back then I was working for a very small lighting company out of Owatonna, and at that time there were no SIP programs or no rebate programs. But the owner of that company actually was out and he pursued NSP at the time, which is now Xcel, and he was asking them and was actually trying to get them to create a rebate program, which in about a year or two they actively did. And it seemed to really help and spur our business at the time, and I was there for 6 years, after which a former partner and myself, two of us started our own business in March of 92 in the Owatonna Business Incubator. And we, because there were no rebates, and that we started calling on customers in the southern part of the state, and there were no rebates with any of the utility companies down there, we actively pursued those utility companies and tried to help promote them and ask and encourage them to start a rebate program, which many of them did, and which really actually increased our business, and we grew fairly rapidly at that point. But then there came a time back in about the late 90s when NSP, because of a business decision, decided to really get rid of a lot of their smaller to medium-sized reps that were calling on local businesses to encourage energy conservation. And for about 3 years, our business really suffered, quite honestly, because of that. They didn't have any reps out there pursuing and actively calling on local and small businesses to encourage them to do any type of conservation, whether it be heating, air conditioning, lighting, or anything. So about the year 2000, the Center for Energy and Environment started a program in conjunction with Xcel Energy and the state of Minnesota. And quite honestly, it was a great shot in the arm for us and for our business, because they were out actively pursuing small businesses that we were calling on. And we actually worked very, very well with them. Because of our experience in the industry, and hopefully because of our reputation at the time, we were asked to be one of their initial program contractors, and we are still yet to this day. And what really even gave their program an additional shot in the arm was when they offered a finance program to go along with that, because we found a lot of customers were very interested in saving energy, but they didn't have the $10,000 to $50,000, whatever the initial investment was going to implement that program. So once they started a kind of a low interest rate finance program, that was even an enhancement to our business as well as hopefully theirs. And quite honestly, energy efficiency and SIP programs and the environment are the utmost importance to our small company, because that's how us and all of our employees make our living, quite honestly. Energy efficiency, of course, helps our customers by reducing their overhead and operating costs, which saves them money, which helps them be more competitive. The SIP programs actually help reduce the initial cost of that project and actually encourages them to implement them programs and the jobs. And we then get a job, so we're able to purchase equipment and go and install it, which has been a huge benefit to us. And quite honestly, to end with, in 2012, our small company was able to do about $8.7 million worth of energy-efficient lighting upgrades in the state of Minnesota, which we employ a little over 60 people full-time. And because of our success, we were able to purchase a 72,000-square-foot building in Owatonna that sat empty for 11 years. Our goal is to move into that facility, which will allow us to grow and expand our business. And quite honestly, one of the most exciting things we feel about energy efficiency is that it's shovel-ready. The technologies are already there, and we actually have the ability and the people to do the install and take care of all of the waste that comes out of those projects. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we have some member questions. And the first member question we have is Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I know I wanted to thank you. A couple weeks ago, I made a comment about the fact that you and I have parked next to each other in the ramp for 9 years, and I made a comment about how you never park within the lines. And since I made that comment, you've now been parking much better, and I just want to say I appreciate that. And
well, you had threatened to take photographs, so.
Yes, so I do appreciate that. I had a couple of questions for Dr. Kushler, even though you're from Michigan State, so if you could come down. First of all, Madam Chair and Doctor, on page 7, there's a term, you use the term levelized cost. Can you just, without blowing us away, just kind of describe for us what levelized cost is and some of the factors that go into that?
Yes, one of the issues with energy efficiency is that it's most often done with one large expenditure up front, but it saves energy over a long period of time, over whatever the life of the measure is. So levelized cost is just a formula calculation that is done to account for the time value of money and spread that initial upfront cost over the lifetime of the measure to come up with a cost per kilowatt hour across that entire time period for the savings that are achieved.
Representative Breflin.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, because I see here, for example, that we have wind as a lower rate than the natural gas combined cycle using this measurement. And I'm wondering, for that one example, many of our wind plants also, or wind production also has peak power plants attached to natural gas, battery storage. Is that built into those costs, or is that listed as a natural gas cost?
That wouldn't show up in the cost of that resource, because that resource is filling one wedge of your resource pyramid, if you will. So what you would, if you wanted to take a look at those kind of effects, you'd do an integrated resource planning model on the entire utility system and take a look at what the effects would be of path A versus path B in terms of your mix of resources.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my final question for the testifier. On page 19, there's the slide regarding, I'm so old, I got to wear my glasses now. This is horrible. Do the current low natural gas prices mean that energy efficiency is not needed? And I'll ask you the question I asked yesterday, and that is that clearly, you know, energy efficiency is always needed regardless of cost. However, it would seem that the cheaper the resource is, the longer it's going to take to get our return on investment. And so my question to you is that with regards to, everyone knows natural gas prices are now at their lowest prices than they've ever been before. Do you feel that that is a disincentive to energy efficiency, or how do we overcome the fact that natural gas is now so cheap that it takes, that'd be a better question. Why is it, with natural gas being so cheap, how do we overcome that in terms of having a longer window on return on investment?
Well, that's exactly the phenomenon that I was trying to respond to, which is, if you will, kind of an unsophisticated response to the fact that natural gas is promoted as really cheap right now, causes some people to have a moment of reflection and say, well, do we need to be saving it anymore? And that's kind of a really misguided level of analysis. The level of analysis needs to be done, I think you're starting to suggest with your question, which is there at the margin there may be some gas efficiency measures that are more difficult to be cost effective, although on average, I have in my appendix slides that I didn't present, a whole bunch of research that's been done showing natural gas programs saving gas at about 250 to 350 in MCF, which is cheaper than your city gate price of gas, even in the low gas price era. So the short and easy answer to that initial big question is certainly energy efficiency is still cost effective and nobody should be thinking about canceling their program. That said, each program should be looked at individually to see what effects the costs do have on the length of payback that will proceed and so forth. But the result of all of that will be portfolios of efficiency programs quite similar to what have seen in the past, that it's still going to be cost-effective for most of the energy efficiency effort. And on the electric side, no question whatsoever. The, you know, 7-cent gas or 7-cent electricity from a gas-fired power plant is still vastly more expensive than energy efficiency on the electric side. Efficiency on the electric side.
Madam Chair, at the risk of sounding unsophisticated or misguided, one of the concerns I have is that there's something called the efficiency paradox, which I believe in, and that is that the cheaper a resource is, the more people will use it. And maybe it's better if we provide an example that if somebody has a small car that can drive a farther distance at a cheaper price, they will drive farther and use more of that resource. Am I mistaken?
Dr. Pushler.
There's been quite a bit of popular press written about the rebound effect is another term that's used for that. I like to refer to that as a classic example of a man bites dog story that the popular press sort of gets enamored with. But there's been a lot of work that's been done to look at specifically the issue of rebound. What do customers do when they put energy efficiency measures in their home? Does it affect their thermostat behavior? Does it affect their other use of that appliance? Do they use it more? And the results have shown rather trivial effects in terms of snapback or rebound effects. Now, if you want to make the argument that lowering everybody's bills means people have more money to spend and somehow they buy stuff that uses more energy, and that's what some of the purveyors of this concept like to talk about, you're basically saying that economic growth is a bad thing then, that because it leads to more energy consumption. I just can't go down that path.
Well, Madam Chair, into the testimony.
Representative Grofflaw.
This will be my final comment, not a question, but with regards to your comments on that, they're actually kind of contrary to a lot of things that we're doing in the state of Minnesota. For example, the governor recently released a budget where he proposed an increase in the cigarette tax. And there's been some discussion among Democrats in the legislature to increase the alcohol tax. And the marketed benefits to this are that because it's more expensive, people will use less of that product. And it would seem to reason that justification is that if the more expensive a product is, the more scarce it is, people will use less of it. If it's more affordable, if it's more abundant, people are more likely to use more of it. And I think there's lots of examples in history where we've seen that with energy production. But on this, I guess we'll respectfully disagree, and I'll wish your Michigan State Spartans the worst of luck the next time they play our Golden Gophers. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Grofflaw, the Tax Committee is meeting in room 10.
Yeah.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. I guess it's probably for Mr. Grant and maybe our utility testifiers. On page 17 of Dr. Kushler's testimony, he talks about decoupling. Specifically, he says, addressing the utility disincentive from lost sales is essential to achieving true utility cooperation in broader energy efficiency objectives. And he suggests that decoupling is a way to address this disincentive. So maybe, Mr. Grant, why don't we have decoupling in Minnesota?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, in fact, we do have decoupling in Minnesota. In 2007, a little-known part of the Next Generation Energy Act created an opt-in possibility for utilities to come forward with decoupling pilot programs to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. So far, two natural gas utilities have done so. CenterPoint Energy, who you've just heard from, and Merck have both presented decoupling programs, and I think that the results so far have been quite promising.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, maybe I didn't hear that Xcel is involved in this decoupling. Maybe they have a response to why they aren't proposing a decoupling incentive.
Would anybody from Xcel like to respond to the topic of decoupling?
I could answer for them.
Or Dr. Kirschner. Yeah. And you guys can feel free to stay up at the testifying table, whether it's Mr. Grant or Dr. Kushler or somebody from Xcel, because we don't know what the next questions will be about. But Mr. Gabler.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm not a decoupling expert. I think what from Xcel's perspective, we have the right model today. I think if you look at our performance in 2011, we exceeded the 1.5%. 2012, we're close to 1.7% energy savings. So, you know, I'll go back to what I call the Minnesota model. For us, is working.
Thank you. Follow up, or you're good?
No, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This week, and this question is for Dr. Kushler. Thank you, Dr. Kushler. This week I had a gentleman from District Energy in my office, and they supply a lot of the energy for St. Paul. And one of the things he has an idea on is the concept that a lot of especially manufacturers or really any you know customer of theirs, a lot of the energy that they use is actually wasted or unused energy. and how what we can. His concept is, what can we do to capture that? There are there is technology in place that would allow that, and that also maybe, you know, his thought is, let's make that a viable, you know, option for people to meet some of these Next Energy Act, Next Generation Act criteria. And I'm just wondering, you know, you cited Massachusetts as being a leader in conservation and so forth, and I'm just wondering if Massachusetts or any other states that you know of are implementing something like that, where they're capturing that wasted or unused energy and then giving it to the guy next door. Thanks.
Dr. Kushler.
Yes, waste heat recovery is an eligible measure in at least some states. I don't recall offhand if Massachusetts has that or not. That along with CHP, combined heat and power, are technologies that are sort of in a gray zone. They're technically not end-use efficiency, and they're not renewables, but they're desirable because they produce a lot of overall efficiencies in the use of energy. So different states have addressed those in different ways. Some allow them to be credited on the renewable portfolio standard side, some on the energy efficiency side. So there are some areas where those types of measures are allowed.
Thank you. Representative Scott, this is the topic we'll be talking about on Monday, the 11th. And I think under Minnesota law, we don't right now allow combined heat and power clearly under either conservation or renewable, unless it's renewably energy powered. So it's something I think we should look at as maybe a bipartisan area we could do something. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will add to that comment, though. We do allow for some of the efficiency measures in transmission and generation to be counted above the 1%. But y'all can talk about that on Monday. My question to Dr. Kushler is, how do we respond to folks who are utilities and others under the Minnesota regimen in particular, but maybe other states are having this experience? And we hear mostly from smaller utilities with a particular customer mix or particular resource as their primary generation resource. Hear from the gas companies as well. So the munis, the co-ops, that they're starting to get worried that the low-hanging fruit has been taken up and starting to run out of space and room and options and alternatives to continue to meet the 1 or 1.5% goals that we've set.
Yeah, I think that's certainly something that I'm hearing more and more lately, a little bit of rumblings about this low-hanging fruit argument. Couple ways to think about that. In my presentation, I showed you a graph of the Pacific Northwest and how long they've been aggressively capturing efficiency for 30 years, and the price that it's coming in at stays below 2 cents kilowatt that whole time. And one nice thing about energy efficiency in general is that advancements in technology keep leapfrogging ahead and providing more low-hanging fruit. So we haven't run out of that fruit tree by any means yet. Now, that's and there are a number of states with longevity in the energy efficiency area, even longer than Minnesota, who are still doing very large-scale efficiency very cost-effectively. So I don't think there's any danger of Minnesota or any state in the Midwest by any means running out of attractive efficiency options. That said, it is true that things are getting a little more difficult in some respects because of stronger building codes in some states. Federal appliance efficiency standards keep moving ahead. So it does require periodic adjustment of program design and some careful thought on how to operate our programs to make sure we can still capture the amount of savings we want to capture. Now, my organization just this year has gone through two very large-scale efforts. One we called the Next Generation Energy Efficiency Programs, where we went out and looked for programs that were not yet in full implementation anywhere, but they're being piloted, some very innovative concepts. And we're just now wrapping up a project to look at the exemplary energy efficiency programs from around the country. And so I read through these program profiles, and there's a lot of very innovative, very exciting stuff going on. And to paint with a broad brush, a number of the utilities that are raising this low-hanging fruit complaint or concern are sort of stuck in second-generation programs, but we're seeing some very good third-generation programs coming along now. So I, as a general statement, I am quite confident there's sufficient efficiency to be done out there. Now, all of that said, there are certain situations like very small rural co-ops and all they have is a residential customer base. There isn't as much that can be done there. I think there could be an argument made to tailor requirements in those kind of circumstances, but as a general proposition, there's still an enormous potential for a cost-effective efficiency out there.
Thank you. We have three questions left and 3 minutes left, so if we can have members ask their questions as quickly as possible. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start with Dr. Kushler since you're there, and then I have a brief comment for Mr. Mark. On page 7 and 8 of the presentation you gave us, you have this is about the cost of the different kinds of electricity resources, and you noted that the cost of natural gas went down between the two. The median cost of just about everything else stays the same, but solar, the solar photovoltaic, had a rather large increase. The cost was about $11 per kilowatt hour on the first graph, and the median is about $18 per kilowatt hour on the second. Do you have some feeling for why that cost went up so much?
Quite honestly, I don't. I mean, my organization specializes in energy efficiency. So we salute renewables folks, but we focus on the energy efficiency aspect. So I couldn't tell you what the factors would be in their estimate on that.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mark, on what's page 3 of ours, you've got a graph about the decrease in weather normalized natural gas consumption. I don't know where he is. You don't have to come up. I was just wondering who I was looking toward. You really have good results, and it's gone down from 100, and I can't read the units here, but from 180 to 80. But with this suppressed zero on the graph, it actually makes your results less credible, because if you're used to looking at graphs, you look at that and go, okay, what's the funny business on this graph? And secondly, it doesn't show us what the potential is for continued decrease in that, or whether there's some level it would be expected to level off or something. So just encouraging people not to do that so we can understand things better on graphs. And then one more thing.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, I think in your question about whether the people that realize the energy savings will then turn around and increase their consumption, I think that we have to remember that this is a self-selected group of people that participate in these, and in the case of the energy-efficient vehicles, it's neglecting the fact that the people going out and buying a Prius are very often tree huggers who are not going to use that opportunity to go out and drive more. Thanks.
Representative Quam, and then Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Dr. Kushler, I noticed on slides 14, 15, 22, and 25, there's a lack of hydro. In fact, today I didn't hear any on hydro. And then also for all of the testifiers, I didn't see much discussion of agriculture and it being a very large industry with the drying. So you've got your natural gas and with all the other, aspects you can do in farming. So is there a reason why hydro isn't in any of the discussions and slides? And then also any comments on agriculture?
Yes, the hydro typically doesn't show up on these sorts of slides because it's not a realistic incremental resource. Essentially, the good hydro sites have been long ago exploited with dams to produce electricity. So if a typical utility in XYZ states considering resource options, hydro is putting in a new dam somewhere is not really an option for them. It's a very cost-effective resource. You know, there are certain regions of the country where it's a big amount of their generation, but it's not a incremental. Nobody's going to be choosing between a gas plant and a hydro plant.
Representative Quam, if I let you follow up, then we're almost 5 minutes over, and I haven't let Senator Osmick ask a question. He said he's ceding his time to you, Representative
Quam. I didn't
Quam.
Answer the agriculture.
Dr. Kushler, sorry about that.
Very definitely, agricultural efficiency programs are a big part of efficiency programs in a number of utilities. In fact, our organization, we routinely, every year, give awards to exemplary programs. We've awarded exemplary agricultural sector programs. So that's embedded in the data that you see on efficiency that these states are doing.
I want to thank all of our testifiers for coming today. I know members have more questions, and they will be probably finding you as they leave, but we try to start on time and end on time as best as we can. Thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.